I heard it today for the first time. I heard my first, radio thing of the song, or the first thing I've heard from this record on the radio this morning. And it's always quite extraordinary when you hear one of your things that you've been working on for ages, and you know what it means, you know everything about it, but the first time you hear it on the radio, you have got the added weight of knowing that there are millions of other people listening to it as well. So you get a completely different perspective on it. Every bit of it, you sort of gets invested with a different meaning, if you like. And it was really, really nice to hear that this morning on the radio, and wonder how people would take to hearing this strange voice talking about for millions of years and stuff on the beginning of it. It's really, really, there are some aspects to making records and making music that you just never yourself get some of the things that are in the stuff you have done until you hear it yourself on the radio with the knowledge that millions of other ears are listening at the same time. You know the history. It's in the last few years that we've been through all our sort of ups and downs, our splits and all that stuff. Rick left, rejoined, Roger left, didn't rejoin. And the album since, say, Animals was more an album where Roger and I were taking command of it, and it was becoming more down to things that were written at home by people, The Wall even more so. The Momentary Lapse of Reason album was recorded again by... It wasn't a terribly cooperative event with everyone really putting their maximum in. And this album, I guess I'd say for the first time since maybe the Wish You Were Here album, is a more joint effort than any album we've done since then, which we started off by going into Nick's studio, Britannia Row studio in London, January 93, with myself, Rick, and Nick, and Guy, the bass player from our last tour. And we just jammed away at anything for 2 weeks, just playing anything that we had in our heads or that we made up on the spot. And then we took all that over to Astoria and started listening to all the tapes and working stuff out. We found we had 65 pieces of music, which we worked on all of to a certain extent. And then we started having these things. We had a couple of sessions which we called the Big Listen, where we listened to all these 65, and all the people involved with it voted on each track, on each piece of music, as to how popular it was with them. And so we then arranged these 65 pieces of music in order of popularity amongst the band. And then we dumped 40 of them and worked on the top 25, which in fact became the top 27 because a couple more got added in. And so the process went on from there, with us working away on all these pieces of music and gradually either merging pieces together or scrapping them, until we finally were down to about sort of 12 to 15 things that we all kind of liked. And in the end, one or two of them went by the way, and we are left with 11 on the album, I think. If you look at the albums, if you look at the things, I think of my sort of my favorite album, I suppose I would say, was the Wish You Were Here album. And the actual process of sitting together in a room with several musicians and actually playing, performing together from nothing is a very interesting, exciting sort of process. And rather than coming into the studio with pieces of music that I already had and pieces of music that Rick already had and stuff like that, and music from anywhere, I thought that it would be better for us to start off from scratch with nothing and just go in and start jamming. Whether or not we would keep all that stuff or whether we'd use any of it or what was not really particularly relevant, but just to start that process off. In fact, we didn't use, several of the tracks are sort of my own songs that didn't even come from that period and have been written since or whatever. It doesn't really matter. But that process was a very, very good if you like, communal process where we all contributed together, and that was what started the album off. It gave us our kickstart. So the start of the album came from a more joint effort than any album that we've made since Wish You Were Here. There's a cohesive sort of thing to it that I'm very fond of. The Division Bell is a bell that rings in Westminster in the Houses of Parliament. And it also rings in the apartments of many of the members of Parliament. And it is a bell that rings to summon all the members of Parliament to go to the House of Commons and to divide into yeas and nays to vote on the issues. Because often in debates in the Houses of Parliament, the members of Parliament are not necessarily all there. Some of them have already made up their minds about what they want to do or are just going to follow the party line. And so they may be sitting at home in an apartment. There's a sort of catchment area around the Houses of Parliament where, within a certain distance, where if you are a member of Parliament, they install this bell in your apartment that's in the House of Parliament. Anyway, they get to the point where they finish debating. They ring this bell. Everyone that's in the area comes down. If you're all the Tories and all the Labour people, all come down to vote one way or the other. So it's a division bell. It divides the yeses from the noes. I do enjoy the scale of the things that of the way we do Pink Floyd things. Obviously, there are times when you think, God, I wish it was simple and we could just go out and play. You know, there are a lot of people want to see us, and we do it well, I think. You know, we do it fairly well, the large things. We make this huge wraparound show that goes right around everyone, which is what we've always attempted to do. Yeah, I do like it. I like doing it that way. We don't really have a huge master plan. We just use our own taste and we do what we do as well as we can do it. I don't really... There's no great rule book or anything that applies that we sort of look through every time and say, well, we must do it this way because that's how we've done it before. So it has its own momentum. The takes on its own momentum. And you just have to be careful to not let some people's imaginations and sense of scale run away with them. You do have to retain some sort of sense of perspective so that it doesn't become stupid, but it does remain a viable, interesting, hopefully moving show. These are the songs that came out of the jamming sessions that we did at Britannia Row in January of 93. Afterwards, we went back to Astoria, to the houseboat, and we listened through to the stuff, and we would join bits together, and we'd, at some point, you have to sort of sit down and say, well, who thought of that bit? Who thought of that? And you try and keep tabs on where things came from so that they're correctly credited. It's very, very, very difficult, and one of the least pleasant aspects of doing the job I do is the deciding on who did what. Polly Sampson is my girlfriend. She's a writer, a journalist and writer, who I've been going out with for a couple of years. And you know, you spend time with your closest friends, and the hours that I'm not in the studio, I'm with her and with one or two other friends. Nick Laird Clues from the Dream Academy as well has been very helpful on this, from the band that Dream Academy that I produced a couple of albums for. And you know, sometimes you need some confirmation and help from other people apart from the gang that are in the studio itself. And so myself and Polly and Nick have sat up many, many nights, all night into the early hours, and both their contributions have been very, very substantial on this record, and Polly's particularly on helping me with the lyric side of things. It's very simple. It sounds kind of stupid when you say it, but I just got a new guitar pedal called a whammy pedal. It just makes your guitar rise up an octave. You just put your foot on this thing and you go, and the guitar goes whoop up an octave. And I started playing with this thing. Someone had just given it to me to try out, and you play it, and Rick started, you know, playing on a keyboard, and suddenly it sounded a bit like whales and whale music and that stuff, and that's how things start. Things just started, and that one just started, and we played it, and it had the the scent of the sea about it, this tune, ever since, you know, probably from the sound of the guitar doing the whale type thing. And we called it the whale piece for ages. Maroon came up as a colour at one point in discussion for some title of something, and then maroon became marooned, and it seemed to fit that tune. Titles is a long, difficult thing sometimes, and that one seemed to fit, and then we played it up a little bit at the end. Putting wave noise and seagulls at the beginning to set the mood a little bit before it goes into it. There's no particular huge significance to marooned, it's just an appropriate title. Wearing the Inside Out came out of us jamming at Britannia Row in just over a year ago. It starts with a bass guitar being plucked in the harmonics with a repeat delay on it and a keyboard starting those first chords. It just was a nice chord sequence at the beginning, which then got worked on. Now, on the last tour, we had Scott Page on the saxophone. Great sax player, lovely guy. And this time, it didn't really look as if we were going to be doing as many songs with saxophone on the tour from the way I was thinking about the tour. And funnily enough, at Christmas, I got a Christmas card from Dick, who I hadn't seen for years and had given up the saxophone entirely and was, I think, unemployed, living in a village near Cambridge, doing nothing. And I knew that years ago he'd sold his saxophones and had gone into being a farrier, you know, shoeing horses. He apparently had given that up as well, and he had bought himself another saxophone a year or so ago, and he just sent me a Christmas card. I rang him up. I didn't even have his phone number before, so I just rang him up and said, just to say how you're doing, and he was just talking to me about it, and I had been thinking about what to do about saxophone on the tour, because we weren't going to need a lot of it, but we needed some, so I asked him if he felt like auditioning for coming on the tour, see if he still had his chops together, and he told me that he thought he was playing better than he'd ever played. And so I got him down to the boat to have a little audition, and he played about three phrases, and myself and Bob said, fine, great, he's still got it. Well, screw this auditioning business, let's see if we can stick him on something. And the only place that seemed really appropriate was the opening for Wearing the Inside Out, so we put him on it. Boom, he's got that tone, it's fantastic, you can recognise it straight away. And so he's on the tour with us as well. Well, mostly on the houseboat, my studio in London. It's called Astoria, which we did quite a bit of the last album on as well. But last time we never really thought we could do drums and that sort of stuff on there because the actual recording room is kind of tiny. We actually tried recording drums in a couple of other places, but we found that it was better in the tiny room. So there we stayed. It's on the Thames River in near London. So it's unusual recording studios. It's covered in windows everywhere, and all you can see are ducks and geese and swans and stuff swimming around outside.